Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 11th, 2000. In the fireside room this evening, we have Gail Gamoff McCoy with the first of her series, Faith vs. Fear. And tonight's title is The Search for Social Justice in America, Incarceration or Rehabilitate. Let's listen in.
I'm McCoy, and I'm here today to discuss Faith vs. Fear. I'm the executive director of Genesis House, which is a rehabilitative organization in Chicago for women involved in prostitution. So some of the things we're going to do during my sessions is we're going to look from the macro problem of incarceration of individuals in the United States of America, and then move towards what our solution has been to this problem. Our program has been featured in Time magazine because we have about a 70% success rate of rehabilitating women who are nonviolent offenders. So that's what we're going to focus on, but initially we'll be looking at bigger issues and then sort of see how we figured out what we thought might be a good thing to do. So what do we really mean when we say faith versus fear? We mean, do we have faith in the inherent ability of a person really to rehabilitate themselves and to recover from the depths of despair, crime, and addiction? And then, if we do have that faith, how do we make that happen, and how do we put that forward? How does society cope with the enormity of the problem? The Department of Corrections is something that I don't think we're paying a lot of attention to, but it's growing, it's becoming very, very big, it's becoming big business in the United States today. One of the things that's happening is they move into small towns, formerly rural towns or industrialized towns that are socioeconomically deprived, and they offer to build a prison, and that will revitalize the community, it will bring in industry, there'll be construction, there'll be physicians, there'll be jobs, and there'll be money to be put into that community. In order to keep that business going, we need to incarcerate people. So because of that, 2% of the people in the United States are now incarcerated. That's the largest amount of any civilized country. And we're going to look a little bit about women. We're going to focus on women, because women are being incarcerated at 3 times the rate that they once were in the past decade. This is partially because of the three strikes against you idea that came out, which has been proven to be a very bad idea. For example, a father of children who's been caught smoking marijuana 3 times is incarcerated. He loses his job. He's no longer a taxpayer. His children can't live in their house. They can't make the house payments. And beyond that, we, the taxpayer, are paying to lock this person up, who was once a citizen, who was productive in society. And really, you could sort of argue and say, perhaps he should have been given a treatment program, something a little more realistic. But because he'd been caught 3 times with marijuana, he's now in prison. And that doesn't seem very rational when you even think of it, even if you're a capitalist, you know, the most dollars and cents idea, it just doesn't make any sense. 75% of the women that are incarcerated in this country are nonviolent offenders. They have not committed violent crimes. 70% are duly diagnosed. That means they have psychiatric problems and substance abuse problems. 70% are mothers of children under 18. What that means is we now throw their children into the foster care system. Not only a very costly system, we're looking at about $25,000 per year to take care of a child in foster care. But it's also because there are cash incentives for people to take care of children. Sometimes the best people are not taking care of this individual's children because of the cash incentive. And that's a sticky question, because if you don't give people money to take care of children, they're not motivated to do it, but it's sort of a double-edged sword there. 80% of the women today that are incarcerated, and there's a lot of work being done now by psychiatrists. I recently spoke on a panel, a national panel in Chicago. There are a number of psychiatrists there that are starting to look at what are the issues, how do women end up in prison. 80% of them have experienced trauma in childhood and beyond. Most often it's incest. Beyond that, there's sexual assault, parents, one or more parents with addictions, violence, and actually one of the statistics is seeing someone killed in front of you as a child. Some of the results of this is they run away, and this is one of the ways girls get involved in prostitution, and or they hook up with a person in a dysfunctional relationship who might often lead them to drugs because they're seeking that self-esteem or that love or that support that they've never gotten in their lives. I'm going to just go over a few facts that are recent, and these are the statistics pretty much in the country today by the National Task Force on Prostitution. They suggest that over 1 million people in the United States have worked as prostitutes. And just in our female population, that's about 1% of the women in the United States. Average prostitution arrests include 70% of the females, 20% of male prostitutes, and 10% of the customers, which is extremely discriminatory. It's 9-1. And that's also interesting when you think about the fact that the arrest of the customer generates income. For example, in the city of Chicago, after all the tickets are written and fines and so on, cars impounded, it's about over $700 for a fine. That generates $1 million in income for the city of Chicago annually. However, when a woman's arrested, it's very costly. So it's interesting that they would arrest the prostitutes 9-1 when it's costly. The ratio of on-street prostitution to off-street, which we talk about saunas, massage parlors, dance halls, escort services, it varies in cities depending on local law, policy, and custom. But street prostitution accounts for between 10 to 20% of the prostitution in larger cities, Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York, and Chicago. However, the street prostitutes are arrested, which are really the ones who are the most impoverished, the most marginalized, because they're more visible. So there's less arrest at in the more secretive, hidden places. And the other problem is when young girls are trafficked from other countries, such as Asia and Eastern Europe, we're seeing a lot of trafficking of underage girls. There's the FBI is doing a study right now about women, young girls coming over the borders of Mexico and Canada. We see that that's hidden, and it's much harder to arrest. So the most visible women are arrested. The percentages of male and female prostitutes vary from city to city. They suggest that 20 to 30% of the prostitutes are male, and many are under the age of 18. Again, one way to make a living when you're a runaway. Substance abuse addiction is relatively common amongst prostitutes on the street. One study showed that nearly 50% of the population of women who did drugs used drugs before they became prostitutes and ended up becoming prostitutes because of their addiction.
What percentage was that?
50%. Violence is one of the major problems for women in prostitution. In Chicago now we have 2 serial killers, perhaps 3, that are killing women in prostitution exclusively. Figures vary, but one report cites 60% of the abuse against street prostitutes is from clients, 20% by police, and 20% in domestic relationships. Between 35 and 85% of prostitutes are survivors of incest or early sexual abuse. So the idea is basically, and I must say that we are against legalization at this point, to start to understand how someone gets to that place and what's happened. And at some point, perhaps learning to be a victim and accepting victimization really doesn't make it okay. So we do not agree with Coyote, by the way. A study of 130 street workers, homeless, who engaged in prostitution or survival sex found that 80% had been physically assaulted. Some had been raped between 8 to 10 times a year. Only 7% sought help, and only 4% reported the rape to the police because basically they're fairly unresponsive to that. A recent study showed that in cases of non-domestic rape and abuse, 5% of the perpetrators identified themselves as police officers, often producing badges and police identification. And previous to this work, I did domestic violence work, and we've had many stories of police officers dragging their wives with guns to their head, telling them if they report this abuse, they're going to be killed. Police, judges, etc., are often also customers. So you see how that system gets entwined. And the legalization of prostitution in this country is being driven by organized crime, as is the trafficking is being driven by organized crime, international organized crime, which is important to think about that. When you think about who's controlling Nevada, it's really no surprise that prostitution is legalized in the state of Nevada. And the women who are leaving the state are telling us that they have to turn over the majority of their money to others, that it's not what it seems. There's some of the small media that comes out that it's really a great thing to do. It's not really true, because we have a lot of women who are escaping Nevada to other places. In fact, there's a very good recovery place in Minnesota that we're in contact with, also in Washington and San Francisco and L.A.
Can you explain what Coyote is and what Nevada's policy is and what
prostitution is legalized? It means that the women are tested for sexually transmitted diseases, that they're in organized situations. The interesting thing is the customers are not tested. The women are. So a customer can basically bring in any disease to the women. And someone can come into a brothel and purchase the services of a woman, and they are basically buy their supplies and things from that place where it's very, very organized. Coyote is a group of prostitutes who call themselves sex workers who are attempting to legalize prostitution in the United States of America, and it's interesting that people like that get more attention, and they're really just, very few people are successfully engaged in prostitution in this country. Arrests of prostitutes, when we talk about social justice, include the use of entrapment, invasion of privacy, and discriminatory laws. Many anti-prostitution laws are unconstitutional if they were challenged in this country. Average arrest, court, and incarceration costs amount to nearly $2,000 of taxpayers' money per arrest. Cities spend an average of $7.5 million on prostitution control every year, ranging from $1 million in Memphis to $23 million in New York City. Finally, in 1949, the United Nations adopted a resolution in favor of the decriminalization of prostitution. This has been ratified by 50 countries, not by the United States. Many countries complied with decriminalization by decriminalizing prostitution per se, leaving all related activities that are criminal, such as soliciting, advertising, drug trafficking, etc., would still be offenses, but prostitution itself would not. In 1973, the National Organization for Women passed a resolution supporting the decriminalization of prostitution. So what would decriminalization mean? We would look at it more as we look at alcoholism, drunken driving, etc., in this country, whereas that would be something where instead of all the money being diverted for incarceration and arrest, the money would be diverted for programs that help women that are involved in this situation. And also, more recently, there are Johns programs, customer programs, being developed in the United States to help the male, because many of the males are sex addicts, like our president, and need some help. So now when they arrest the men, they're referring them to counseling, so that they can also figure out what they're doing. There's a great program in San Francisco called SAGE, where former women in prostitution come and express their feelings and how they felt about the men, and how if a man offered them more not to wear a condom, if they were HIV positive, they didn't really care. They would say, okay, No condom. And believe it or not, this day and age with what's going on, many people pay more money for a woman not to use a condom. And the women, if they're drug addicted, of course are going to take the money and not worry about public health issues or concerns. So when we really start to look at the problem, the enormity in this country, let alone the trafficking of young girls, and so many girls enter prostitution between the ages of 13 and 15. That's again why we're against legalization. Women don't turn 21 and decide to be prostitutes. This is something that happens in childhood. Also, if you look at who's trafficked and coming in from other countries, it's not 25, 30-year-old women that are worth a lot of money. It's girls. It's young girls. They did an expose on Israel where they're bringing a lot of girls in from Eastern Europe, and they basically show them sitting behind like a glass, sort of like in a zoo, on these little benches, and the men walk through this little thing and sort of pointed, you know, on there like which one they want, and they were all posing. And they've done that with also, I've visited Thailand and some other countries, and oftentimes the family sends the girls there because they can't make it in a farming community. And the girl will think it's only for a little while, and she'll send the money back to the family. But normally that never happens. She never gets back home. She never gets to her family. But they literally send her out to do that. I know we get calls from schools in the city of Chicago where fathers have sent their girls out to prostitute because they're addicted to drugs, and they ask their daughters to go out and prostitute. So it's a very serious, serious problem when you think about the human rights of individuals and children in general. There have been some recommendations that have come out of numerous studies about what could we really do in this country. The first is to stop enforcing and prosecuting prostitution and crimes by the police. Instead, focus on the quality of life and the infractions which neighborhoods complain. If you look at what neighborhoods are complaining about, the activity, the fact that prostitution, there's drug activity, if prostitution's going on, locking someone and putting them back on the street is doing absolutely nothing to help the problem that citizens are complaining about. You know, there's we acknowledge it's a serious problem, but when somebody's back out in 24 hours or 48 hours, nothing's being done to help the problem at all. We would redirect the funds from the prosecution, the public defense, the court time, the legal system's overhead, and the incarceration into these programs that are rehabilitative programs and that actually help women. The programs would go, and men involved in prostitution, and transgenders as well. These would go towards services, alternative programming such as ours, intensive rehabilitation, and preventing children from becoming involved in prostitution, including the trafficking. Recently, we had a visit from a man in Los Angeles who was going on Oprah, and he took all our women onto Oprah. And he was formerly a sex addict, and he helps people get out of sex addictions. And what had happened to him is he had been kidnapped from a playground when he was a child and used in pornography. And a lot of pornography is also children that are underage and children that disappear. And Andrea Dworkin does a lot of work on that, and she has excellent film about violence and pornography. And she interviewed a woman who had been in pornography, introduced to it as a child. She was talking about her baby that was eventually killed by sexual abuse from customers. And she had suffered some psychological damage, obviously. And she really couldn't figure out if it was wrong. And it was very frightening to watch, and to watch her face when she was trying to figure out if it was wrong that her child had been killed by the customers, because she said, well, this is what happened to me when I was a child. I think it's wrong. But she was really unclear. And of course, we know that's dissociative disorder. I mean, there's a psychological term for that. But it's pretty frightening. And a lot of women who have endured this abuse do have dissociative disorders. So I have just a few conclusions and then a couple questions and then discussion. The current response of prosecuting the women and the nonviolent offenders does a lot of harm, but it really doesn't do any good. So why do we allow it? Why do we continue to pay for it? And why do we pay for it at five times the rate it costs of rehabilitation? And there's actually Ted Koppel is doing a lot of work on this right now, which is interesting. But he showed a program like ours. With no intervention, there's an 85% recidivism rate to prison. It's basically $32,000 or more to keep a woman in prison. And if she's ill, it's more. If there's children in foster care, it's more. In fact, in one analogy he made, I usually talk about dollars and cents, but he said we could have sent her to Harvard for a year instead of putting her in prison. And why do we choose to put her in prison rather than send her to Harvard? They had, after an intervention like ours, it went to from 85 to a 20% recidivism rate, which was amazing because that's the statistic for our program. It was an intensive program, so it showed that we could really change. So if we look at, we say, even if 60% of the population or 70% of the population could be rehabilitated, why aren't we giving them that chance? It really doesn't make sense. Because even if the 30% or 20% end up going back, you've still intervened in the lives of 60% of this population. Beyond that, if you look at the fabric of society, what are we doing when we're locking up 2% of our population, separating parents from children? Then the children then begin that cycle of violence. They're abused. We know there's sexual abuse in foster homes that's been proven over and over and over again. So then we set the children up for that next generation of being incarcerated. And we never break that cycle. And I can't think that can be good for any society, really, if you think about it. So we have, the way we do it now, we have not solved quality of life concerns. When we simply look at quality of life for citizens that are exposed to this, substance abuse, drug trafficking, drugs on the street, prostitution. We get women from all over the country because of gambling and gambling boats. The first call I got from Iowa, I was shocked. Iowa prison sending someone, what are they doing in Iowa? Gambling boats. And it, you know, every day I learn something new myself because there's really not a lot of expertise in the United States on this. And I always thought gambling Las Vegas and somehow, gambling boats on the Iowa River. And Iowa never, hit me, but it's true. Wherever there's gambling, there's prostitution. So we need to think about those issues. Do we want to keep, and people who talk about gambling anonymous, Gamblers Anonymous, if the money is coming into the boats and if it's coming into the community, what's often forgotten, it's coming from somewhere. It's coming from somebody's household, it's coming from some working person, it's coming off their credit cards. It's coming, it just doesn't come to the gambling boat and get infused in the community, which is often the argument. You really have to take that next step and say, where did the money come from? Mm-hmm. That now the community has $5 million from people that have run up 7-10 credit cards. I know a woman now who we tried to get into Gamblers Anonymous. She's lost two jobs. She lost her home recently, and all of her credit cards are maxed. And she was a manager in an optical store. And she's now unemployed because of her gambling problem, because she spent all night on the boats and trying to win back her money. So we also have not addressed the discriminatory nature of arrests. 9-1. What's that about? Again, when the arrests of customers generate income, and would give us an opportunity to intervene at that level and say, many, many customers are obviously married. What's going on here with you? What's going on that you're seeking out this activity? Hugh Grant's a great case in point. What was going on there? Interesting to think about. So we need to think about the fact that the arrests and incarceration are costing the America and the taxpayer hundreds of millions of dollars. And that response to this problem that begins in childhood with really the abuse of children in our country deprives citizens of positive responses, which would really solve the problem. And that's quality programming, which is cheaper, and better for society in the long run. I've prepared a couple questions, and then if you don't want to talk about these, we can just take questions at large. My first question is, some people would say that if someone commits a crime, they should be removed from society. They should be put away and keep others safe. Do you think that's true, or do you ever think there's any exceptions to that? Why or why not?
I think there's a strong movement in our country right now towards zero tolerance for crime. Crime loosely defined, I guess, but tightly defined, as it were. But I've watched the legislature in our state at work, and the public opinion that comes to them influences laws is, let's get rid of the folks that don't want to be good citizens. Mm-hmm. Let's remove them. So our prison systems are alive and well.
That's right.
Well, I think you said it in the beginning, it's a money, big money business for small towns to build up their income. And why work on trying to rehabilitate the man or the woman if Sony got a maximum prison in Texas? You know, it's all about money. It's all about money right now.
Well, it's interesting to note that when you're in prison, you can get drugs, and all these things are going on in prisons. You're not even removing people from substance abuse. I mean, anybody who's been incarcerated can tell you that the business is as usual. So you're thinking that maybe the person's away from drugs and so on, but that's not really happening either, because the guards can make extra money by bringing in drugs. So it's not really removing the person from anyway. And in most cases, it hardens the individual and teaches them things probably they didn't know beforehand, before they got in. And again, that's why the recidivism happens, because it just is a whole different way of life. It also removes your identity. I was in a social justice group, and there's a sister there who goes down to the School of Americas and protests every year, because, of course, you know, they kill nuns, unfortunately, after they learn how to kill people. And we train them. So the priests and the nuns have a little problem with the School of Americas. And she happened to cross the line one too many times, and she was about a 65-year-old nun, and they threw her in prison for a year. And she was talking about the experience, and that for a long time she forgot her wallet, and she forgot her purse, and she forgot all the things that were her identity because she'd been stripped of that. I mean, she was told what to do, and, you know, when to do it and when to sit down, and there was nothing that you're used to having is your identity. And she said for a long time, even though she was in relatively brief time, maybe a year, it was very hard for her to take her identity back. And I thought that was very insightful. I had never really thought about that before, because sometimes one of the issues is learning how to take responsibility again and know who you are again when the authority has sort of told you all that for so long.
If I can jump in on the nun, I have a friend, Bill Bixel, who was a Jesuit priest who was 70 years old and arrested.
Ooh.
And he was thrown in the federal prison in Sheridan, Oregon, which happens to be right below the novitiate where he had gone to get his training, also where I began my training in the Jesuits. And what surprised me was he's kind of like a convict, a nonviolent and a very prayerful man. But when I asked, I said, Bix, you know, could you celebrate the Eucharist? No. So that what you think would be healing and redeeming in maybe a situation like that was not allowed.
That's an excellent, excellent point. And then again, what are we doing locking up priests and nuns that are protesting the School of America?
And his was the School of America, and he painted something on the Fort Benning. He painted something.
Good for him. You gotta love that. But it is. I mean, you even think about that. We're, you know, incarcerating people like that because they should have a voice in what's going on in there.
Mm-hmm. Now, what did the, You and I both know that what happens in Chicago, often in borderline neighborhoods where there's wealth on one side and poverty or working class on another side, but often just on busy city streets, neighbors get together in high dudgeon and indignation, and they say, there's prostitutes on our streets, and our children have to walk. Our wives get propositioned when they're coming home from the grocery store, and you know, we have to do something. And then, so a community group will form, and they'll take great pride in call each other and say, I called the cops, I saw one, I called the cops, I saw one. What should they do?
I think they can put pressure on I don't know how many people have community policing now, like CAPS. But one thing that you can do is find out start looking at what the cost is, what you're spending as a taxpayer, and look and pressure them to offer rehabilitation and good programming for people in the community. So there's a permanent solution as opposed to a temporary, because I think most people are very intelligent and can see the same person's back on the same corner relatively soon. And what we are seeing in the city of Chicago, which is more what I'm going to talk about in the next session, is judges are responsive, police are responsive. People that weren't so responsive before are beginning to be more responsive because they see the same person over and over and over. And when they see that person, they look worse, they look sick, they look bad the next time they see them. And we get a lot of support from judges, from detectives. Actually, the head of VICE approached me about trying to figure out how we could access that $1 million. And he said, I thought it would be such great justice, speaking of social justice, if Genesis House got the money from the arrest to help the women. And that, he sought me out. And he was, I think, either a PhD or a master's in criminology. I think the face of higher level police who can change policy. The Department of Justice is very interested in these issues and funding these kind of programs that will really look at this. But you'll see that there are people that think it through, and if you just, again, weigh cost to not only fiscal cost, but cost to society and cost to human beings, and there's a chance for a person to recover. And people that are nonviolent offenders, you have to remember, are very highly rehabable. It's unlike a sociopath or a psychopath or, people that we know from statistics are very difficult to rehabilitate. And I'm not saying they shouldn't be given a chance either, but nonviolent offenders normally have a very high rate with proper programming to be helped. And that's something to keep in mind, too.
Well, I find it really interesting in our community, we live here in Washington, in Spokane, we had a number of serial killers and some young girls who were prostitutes were being victimized and killed. And the neighborhoods started to deal with the problem, and one of the solutions that they proposed was just that because customers and prostitutes are picked up and arrested, but they proposed that these wealthy men who are picking up these young girls said their picture be put in the newspaper because it came out that some pretty influential people. And that was squashed right away. And that seems like a really very effective way, to at least start to address some of the issues in terms of women being victimized and these wealthy, influential men who don't want the public to know that this is what they're doing on the side.
Well, and then that leads to part of that would probably be counseling and programming as to what are you really doing? Because, you do see it's very interesting because we get all the statistics to look at who the customers are and where they live and what kind of vehicle they were in and so on and so forth. And it's a real eye-opener. And I think you can't look at one side of the problem without looking at the other. And so, it's the only kind of, to me, transaction where the person who's demanding the service is usually let go, and the person who's providing the service that's demanded is punished. It's a very interesting thing when you think about it. Why does the blame lie on the person that's providing the service that is being demanded? just when you think about it. But I think it's harder for people to face those issues. I know at one time, before I was at my present position, the women were allowed to go on Sally Jesse Raphael. And all the women in the audience were, you know, screaming at them and indignant about it. And I thought, well, why aren't you going home and screaming at your husband? You know, because obviously someone is paying the money, you know. Let's take it out on the victim. Just sort of like this blame the victim mentality. It's all their fault. No, you know, well, the customers are just as much responsible. And I don't know why it's so easy just to, like, you know, it's, let's get rid of the prostitutes. We're still not going to get rid of people demanding the service unless you look at what are their issues as well.
But I think it's probably how it's the easy way out, and this group of people doesn't have the money or the clout to work for change in the laws.
You'd be amazed, though, how much letters to legislators. I went down to Springfield, Illinois, which is our capital, to lobby for domestic violence funding, which, to my knowledge, no prostitution organization had ever received in the past. And I did this in the wake of the first round of serial murders in the city. And I went to our legislator, Sarah Feigenholz, and I went to some of the aldermen, got support, political support. And the first year, we were given $125,000 just by, and we really have no clout in terms of voting clout or money clout. But what I've been told when I've been down lobbying for something is that people usually don't write any letters about anything, believe it or not. So if someone gets letters about something, they actually pay attention to them. If a mayor or an alder person or a state legislator, congresswoman, congressman gets letters, they will pay attention, and it can alter policy. And there's a group studying us right now, and they used to be called the Taylor Institute, their national institute. Now they changed it to a fancier name recently, the Center for Something Change. I haven't memorized it yet. But they do studies, statistical studies, in order to change policy and produce really not, and go, you know, politically to look at what kind of money. And a perfect example is the Congressional Black Caucus. Just really raised the roof about money not going to minority populations for AIDS and HIV. And their first time out, they got $300 million. And next year, they're lobbying for $1 billion, and it will probably be around $700 million for marginalized populations, because AIDS and HIV are going up in heterosexual and minority populations. So, I mean, and that came directly from grassroots efforts from communities, then talking to their Congress, and then Congress going and saying, you know, we want this money. And it happens. And grassroots things really do change. And there's a lot of grassroots movements going on for needle exchange, because the federal government doesn't accept needle exchange. And all the studies show that needle exchange brings down AIDS and doesn't increase addiction. Because if an addict can't get a clean needle, it's not like, well, I guess I won't use drugs today because I can't get a clean needle. They're going to use any needle that's there. And they are at risk for hepatitis, which is coming back in this country very strongly, hepatitis C and HIV. So
they have the needle exchange in Seattle.
We do in Chicago as well. But interestingly enough, in our federal reports, we cannot say that we partner with needle exchange people, because the federal government just, no matter that all the evidence is there. And it's, you know, wouldn't we rather cut down on disease? I mean, let's think about this, public health issues. But there are cities, like you say, where if you lobby, you have it. We have it in Chicago as well, and it's funded by the Department of Health and Department of Human Services.
Gail, may I get back to the incarceration question again? Where, kind of, why, or what might be the psychology of the persuasiveness about why societies or citizenry still seems to think that incarceration is the way to go? Because as you've noted, at least statistically, it's not the way to go. Economically, it's not the way to go. And yet, it seems that citizens and politicians are still persuaded that it is the way to go. So what kind of psychology or what factors are at work there to keep that mentality going?
Well, I think one of the things that I studied about was the fact that our systems are based on English systems, which are largely paternalistic and punitive sort of in their approach to social problems, and we filter down from that. And I think it's very short-sighted as well, because I think it's just the idea of, okay, it's get the person away from me, and not thinking any further beyond that. What happens to that person? What happens to their children? What are the costs to society? And I do think there's a lot of lobbying and a lot of pressure from the Department of Corrections, because this is very, very big business. There's a lot of money. I mean, prisons are hugely expensive. And when you look at, I mean, right now they're privatizing care inside of prisons, and you can see drug treatment positioning themselves to get contracts with the prisons. So they're outsourcing all this stuff, but they're not doing very good work. And I mean, we have a recent example. They have people that are not even, that's another social justice issue. Minorities and people like this don't get the kind of psychiatric care that the wealthy get. So often it's ineffective. Psychiatric counseling, psychiatric care, it's not the right medication, the right things aren't being given to them, so they don't get better. So they're privatizing with people that give bad service. And we had a woman who came into our program from an unnamed supposed treatment program that does a lot of work in corrections. And she obviously, the minute she got in, we knew she had a sleeping disorder, she had an eating disorder, she was up all night. How could they not have seen this? In the program she was, well, we found out her counselor had been in recovery herself for 2 years and did or didn't have a GED and had never been a counselor before. And that was supposedly her counselor. That's ridiculous. But those are the kinds of people that the Department of Corrections are going to, you know, here's your so they can say on paper you're getting counseling, but it's not effective. And it's not quality, because it's the same as anything else. You have to pay people of quality to give quality service. You know, you have to pay a good psychiatrist to give good psychiatric service. So I think it's a combination of those factors. And what I'm told is just there's right now, the politicians just are really lock up, three strikes and you're out crazy, and building prisons. And this is just the prevailing atmosphere in Washington. So I think there's starting to be sort of some sort of, sort of backlash to that, because I'm seeing a lot more things in the media. I'm seeing things about, social justice for adolescents, with all of a sudden adolescents are being punished like adults, and people starting to respond to that. So I think there's starting to be a change. But for years, and with the Bush stuff in Texas and all the people that are being, being executed in his state, and how many of those things were correct and not correct. So it's interesting. But why? I mean, I guess I try and get inside of their heads, but it's so hard for me because it doesn't make sense to me sometimes, other than the money in the Department of Corrections. And they say if their constituents, if the voters want people locked up, than whatever their voters tell them. But I think it's because the voters are uninformed about what's going on.
I don't want to speak as one who's uninformed. What would be the difference between decriminalizing and legalizing?
Well, legalizing puts a rubber stamp on it and organizes brothels.
So, like in Nevada.
Right. Okay. And decriminalization just basically makes it just, again, like being an alcoholic. You're not a criminal. You have a problem, and society acknowledges you have a problem and that you need help for that problem. So it's a different idea than, hey, let's make this okay. And actually what's interesting is when they do studies on women in prostitution and they ask, would you want your daughter to be a prostitute, virtually 100% say no. And if you had it to do over again, would you be a prostitute? Almost again, 100% say no. And was your self-esteem higher before you were a prostitute or after? Self-esteem was higher before. So when you just think about that simplistic of an idea, why would we legalize this? If they would daughter do it again, and it lowered their self-esteem. You know, but... I'm sorry.
If you take me and put me in a jail cell, now you have a prostitute, a drunk, and I'm angrier than before. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I sit there and I meditate and I pray on your kids, mm-hmm. on you, on society, period. It gets no better mm-hmm. for me. Mm-hmm. And that's just a lot more hurt than hell mm-hmm. to lock me up.
And that kind of led me to a question. You talked about most of these are non-violent offenders. Is there any statistics to show where a non-violent offender becomes a violent offender after incarceration?
I'm not familiar with that statistic, but the three top non-violent crimes are something, you know, if they were involved in a drug transaction, a property crime, basically they steal something, and prostitution. But however, most that are arrested for property or drug transaction were also usually involved in prostitution because they're into their addiction. And that's why this has become obviously a problem, because of the drug problem in our country today. And it's also interesting when you talk about, back to our theme of social justice, that you never see the kingpins, the drug kingpins in this country being locked up. And occasionally they give up someone from South America. That always cracks me up. You know, it's like, well, we got Zozo Rodriguez, you know? And it's like, oh, so nobody in Miami was the connector there. You know, it really kills me, because you never see anybody. The people with the boats and the jets and the planes and everything in this country, you see the low-level people again on the street getting nailed, so people can feel good about drugs and not look at, like, whatever sanctioned by the government or the government, you know, they have to be looking the other way for half of this stuff that comes in on these planes and everything else. And where are those people getting arrested? That just fascinates me. And then, of course, when the one died having plastic surgery, does everybody remember that story? Well, that was, oh, the drug kingpin died having plastic surgery. You know, in Mexico. Well, gosh, you got him. You know, that was great, DEA. You know, so absurd. And never in this country you see the lower level people arrested, which is, again, unfair.
But that, I think, is part of my question, too, is at what point do lower level people become more dangerous, because we as a society have not been responsible in rehabilitating them, and then we're really at fault for creating violent offenders at some point. I mean, I don't know where you cross that line or where we can do some research to understand that better, to go to our legislators and say, hey, if we would deal with nonviolent offenders in a more effective way, then we wouldn't need the three strikes are out laws.
Even juvenile offenders.
Right.
Because juvenile offenders, you know, grow up.
I'd like to comment on what you're saying. I'm the newest staff person at Genesis House, but most of my experience has been in mental health. And what mostly happens, from what I've experienced as a case manager with nonviolent criminal acts, have been that those people don't necessarily become violent. They start developing mental issues. Mm-hmm. And so then you have a totally different problem that starts developing. And so whereas this person could have been really rehabilitated, now they have mental issues, and now they're in the mental health department at that point. So all of a sudden, where this person used to go to jail, mm-hmm. they start having a higher recidivism at the mental health hospitals.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good point.
And it really does increase, because I've seen clients that have gone to jail on like something like a petty theft, come out because they were tormented, mm-hmm. may have been raped, beaten mm-hmm. up, you know, and they stopped. So what they did was, because they were getting that way, they went to the mental health ward and started saying that they were hearing voices, because maybe they heard it from one of their inmates. If you say you're hearing voices, they'll put you on the mental health ward. Well, the doctors at the hospitals in these jails don't really evaluate them. If they tell them that they're hearing voices, the first thing they do is they give them Howl Dog. Mm. Howl Dog is the highest, it has the highest level of a psychiatric medication that's really out there. It's the oldest one, one of the oldest ones, but it also has very damaging effects if you take it and you're really not psychotic. And so then these people take this Howl Dog, and then something really does happen. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden they're in the mental health field. And that's what happens, their recidivism rate in the hospital goes up. And where this person might have only been in jail one time, they come in the hospital 20 times.
I wanted to elaborate a little bit more on what Demetri was saying. I myself have a very long prostitution history, and it just goes to show that each time that I was arrested for prostitution, I came back with a vengeance. Mm-hmm. To, you know, just continually stay out there with a vengeance. You know, I was mad and pissed because I was arrested, so, and they screwed up my money, they screwed up my, you know, the whole priority of the situation for me. And most of the time, the money that I made was given to the courts. It wasn't, I didn't get to keep anything that I was caught with, any transaction that I was caught with. It went to the court system. And they usually fed me a line saying that when you went to court, that I would get, when I went to court, that I would get the money back. None of the money was ever saw, and some of it was in the hundreds. And so each time that that happened or occurred, I went back out with even more vengeance. So it's hard for, but you know, now that I have Genesis House really, really does give me a whole lot of insight, a lot of help. The staff, the new staff, Gail, they offer us a whole lot of different opportunities. They give us, and it is a second chance at life. Mm-hmm. I decided to turn my will and life over to God in jail because I had gotten too comfortable being there. Usually, every time that I was arrested, I fought, kicked, bit, scratched, spit at you, and there were numerous things. And the last time that I was arrested, I didn't do any of that. I was very content in my situation, and wound up being in the Department of Corrections incarcerated because prostitution now, 3 strikes, becomes a felony. And a felony, 3 felonies gets you 1 to 3 in the penitentiary. That's how they're working. I don't know if it still stands because I'm in recovery. But, and I was too comfortable with the situation. It was my 3rd felony. And I lucked out. I really lucked out because I had gotten too comfortable to the fact that where the 2 months that I was there, I thought it was going to be my life. I really thought it was going to mean that that's the way I was going to spend the rest of my life, was in jail. So I had the opportunity through the counselors there to do some footwork and get a hold of Genesis House, which was prior to that, I was a crisis client, and decided to just throw in the towel. And I am a homeless person also. I have no family to turn to cry on, lean on, beg from, borrow from, or any of that. So the only Genesis House has become my family now. All of them my sisters, some of them I call mama. And it's a very loving and caring organization. And the bad part about it is that there's a waiting list for people. Because, I don't know if Gail has mentioned it, but we only house 8 to probably maybe 10 women. And we have a numerous amount of people, women that are wanting to see Genesis House. It's a pleasant opportunity. You know, they do help us with tutoring. They help us with emotional boundaries, emotional groups, spirituality, all the addictions, CANAA. They help us with a lot of things. And I'm grateful for the opportunity that I finally had gotten off my rear end and decided to do something about it, getting sick and tired, mm-hmm. and having Genesis House be one of my options. I'm the newest one at Genesis House. And they have really put a whole new insight in my life. And going back for more pain and more misery is not an option today.
Great. Thank you. A nice testimonial. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about the program. We see about 4,000 to 5,000 women annually, but that's the sad part. Our waiting list to get into our housing program, because it is very progressive, is usually 75 to 100 women on any given day. And it's a great frustration, because as people know that we have this great program, they want to come. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about that, but it's when you finally figure out how to do it, and it really takes a lot of common sense to figure it out. It's sad that there aren't more programs, and there are very few programs in this country. I think basically because they're driven by bureaucrats, and a lot of times if you look at who's designing programs, and I've noticed this working with a number of bureaucratic organizations, it's people designing programs that don't know anything about the population, who don't know what they're doing, or again, it's driven by the insurance industry, 21, 28 days, which doesn't do any good whatsoever. Yet we'll spend $100,000 having someone go into a 21-day program 10 times mm-hmm. and fail 10 times mm-hmm. and not really get the message that this didn't work, mm-hmm. you know, and where the money really needs to be put is the program after that, mm-hmm. you know, because you don't take away, you know, 18, 20 years of abuse and victimization in 21 days. Mm-hmm. And of course, we also know about the curve. I mean, any intervention, I mean, a person could shake your hand and you'd like go up and you'd feel really good. And then there's a dip. And when the dip comes, that's when people need to be in the programs that are 24-hour and very intensive and long-term programming.
I worked for Genesis House for a while, and then as part of that work, I worked in Cook County Jail. And at one point, I asked, they have a program in the women's division of the jail for drug addiction. So I was talking to the person in charge of the jail, and I said, what percentage of your ladies are in here because of drugs? And she said, somewhere between 80 and 90. And I said, what percentage of the women incarcerated are in your drug treatment program? Because it's residential, it's long-term, you're stuck there, you might as well get drug treatment. I mean, it would, you know, I know they'd have to hire good counselors for it to work and do some nutritional work and some health work, but it seemed obvious that if 90% of your people are there because of drugs, we want to have 90% of them in drug treatment. She said 1/12 of them. And I said, why if you have such a small program? And she said, oh, because our program is too hard for most of them.
Mm. What? And then interview a counselor and see how really tough that program is.
Yeah, right. So it just seems ridiculous because, I mean, if the program is too hard, obviously make a different program. That doesn't mm-hmm. But right. she just thought it was obvious. And then later, one of the guards who overheard this whole conversation said to me, well, you know why that is. And I said, why? And they said, because we need to stay in business.
Oh. Yay! Another testimonial.
Yeah. You know, I'm a high school counselor, and I went to a workshop this spring on teenage problem gamblers.
Ooh.
And it really opened my eyes to how insidious gambling is in our community. I live and work in Washington State, and you wouldn't think that we really have gambling, but if you go to our Indian reservations, we have casinos, but even our state lottery. Mm-hmm. And I asked about things like high schools doing fundraising activities like car auctions and, you know, raffle tickets and things like that. And they said that's all to a problem gambler. Their eyes just light up, and teenagers were talking on a panel. And it makes me just wonder if we've got drugs and alcohol as one issue, we've got sexual abuse and all of that, but this whole range of gambling that I think even the average citizen who might say, no, I don't have this problem, I don't have that problem, how many people are betting on ball games, and you know, just things that we don't even think about that can be taken to another level very quickly.
Well, and if you have an addictive personality, that's just another, I mean, maybe the certain amount of people it won't affect them or impact them, but if you have an addictive personality and you get hooked, that's it. You'll lose everything.
Mm-hmm. And how many of the Johns actually have problem gambling? I mean, is there a correlation between any of that that we know of?
Well, the correlation, the studies, we've worked with different sort of sampling what kind of person is out soliciting, and the interesting thing was over 50% of them had arrests for violence, some type of violence, either domestic violence, battery, attempted murder. So it was interesting to note that, and when you think that 50%, I mean, they had to get arrested doing both things. So my guess would be that it's probably higher. So this person is, at least we know, predisposed to violence. And that's one of the things. And probably because, you know, there's an idea of victimizing this woman who society or police or a lot of people are not going to protect, so it makes a lot of sense that that type of person would be out looking for someone, and I think the murders really dramatically show that. But we do know that what percentage are gamblers, but again, you see prostitutes around gambling, around off-track betting places. I mean, all those kinds of places are where prostitutes are working, because if someone's coming out with money, obviously, from the gambling, so certainly they probably are exposed to it more than someone who's not hanging around in gambling areas.
How does the Genesis program work? Is it like a Delancey Street program? Are you familiar with that?
I'm familiar with the name, but actually I'm going to talk about that my last day. I have to build the suspense, because I believe it's about time to turn off the mic. So I really appreciate everybody coming. I think I will have two more sessions. From going to the bigger problem, we're going to look at go in a little smaller, and the last session will really be about Genesis House's response and how we developed a program that, for some reason, which is kind of interesting to me, it's now a national model. It's a model for the Center for Disease Control, for SAMHSA, which is Substance Abuse CSAT, Center for Substance Abuse Treatment. We had a mayor's grant where we went around. I actually went to different parts of the country setting up program. One place I went to was Jacksonville, Florida, which has the second highest incidence of AIDS in Florida. And also our court model, which I'll talk about, is one of the first in the country. So I thank you all for coming at this late hour.